Garrick Utley has been in television news for 3.5 decades. 30 of those years with NBC, then a few with ABC, and most recently with CNN. In his new book, You Should Have Been Here Yesterday, A Life in Television News, he looks back on those 3.5 decades and the future of television news as well. And I'm very happy to welcome a man whose face and voice Americans have known on network television for all these years, Garrick Utley. Good morning, Garrick.
Good morning, Paul. I can offer the voice, but unfortunately not the face on radio, but that doesn't matter.
The voice is recognizable enough, and people will just have to imagine the face there. What does that mean, you should have been here yesterday?
What it means goes back, would you believe it, 30 years ago when I was in the heyday of network news and the foreign correspondent. I and some colleagues were having lunch one day or a drink after a hard day and wondering about what we would entitle the memoirs all foreign correspondents have to write about their supposedly exciting lives. And we came up with titles, and mine was You Should Have Been Here Yesterday. The only problem, Paul, is it took me 3 decades to put some words to the title and get it between 2 hardcovers, but here it is finally.
Why did you choose that title?
I think because any journalist, a reporter who's out covering a story, how often in our lives do we get to the scene of the big event and somebody is there, a competitor from CBS or ABC, saying, oh, you should have been here yesterday, Garrick. And that's what so much of life is about, so it seemed to be a good title.
Let me get into a couple of great stories that you've covered through the years. And one of them that intrigued me as I was reading through the book and also looking through the accompanying CD-ROM, which comes with the book, which has a 30-minute kind of history of your years in network news and even before you got in there. But one of the stories that intrigues me was one you covered in 1985 in the small country of Belize, a country that had no television, right?
Could you believe it? I was based here for NBC in New York City, and I said, I want to go somewhere which is the supposed end of the world where there's no television. Well, you don't have to go, or you didn't have to go that far. You went down to Central America, tiny Belize on the Gulf of Mexico, just east of Guatemala. And we went up to a remote town near the Guatemalan border, and there was no TV system in the country, as you say, but the local entrepreneurs were putting up backyard satellite dishes, and they were stealing the signals off the satellites off North America. So there we were in a place that had no regular television, people that didn't even know the outside world, and yet every night they were sitting there watching Johnny Carson. It was amazing because you saw the impact of this thing called television via satellite and how it changed people's lives. There was a local merchant who was doing this, and he said, today, this morning, people were coming in asking for Mr. T breakfast cereal and Sears lawnmowers and stuff like that. Nobody had heard of them 2 weeks ago before the satellite started. The impact of TV.
And this was their only source of information about anything elsewhere in the world, right?
The only visual source. They had radio. They had a couple of flimsy newspapers. But it was when you opened that window to the world, the images coming in, that they could see how other people lived. They had read about it, perhaps. Occasionally, they had seen a movie. But now they could see it on a day-to-day basis, and we don't think about that much here in the United States, the impact of international satellite television. We certainly do at CNN with our global network,
right?
But it's enormous.
When television first started in the United States, the people in the movie industry said, uh-oh, we're going to be in trouble. People are going to stay home. They're not going to go to the movies. That actually happened in Belize, didn't it?
It did indeed, because there was one small movie theater in this town of 2,000 or 3,000 people, and it closed down. It closed down within a month after this TV satellite images started coming in. And remember, not only were they getting satellite for the first time, some of these homes didn't have electricity. We'd go out to these homes, very simple homes, and they had the TV hooked up to an automobile battery. And that's how they were getting Johnny Carson.
Wow. Now, what did the local government think of this? Because, after all, in small countries, they like to control their television as much as they can. And here was the great invader of North America, the United States, coming into their country without them having any say-so.
Well, some of the government officials we talked to didn't like it at all, because government officials like to have a lot of authority over their country. And they said it's not only the morality or the way we see the world that's being changed, it also pushes tremendous economic burdens on the government. Because people will say, well, why can't we have our roads paved the way they do in Dallas or in Dynasty? We don't have them paid with gold. We just want to have them paid. And sometimes that's beyond the reach of a poor country. They had a point. But there are other interesting things. People there in Belize were watching WGN, which is this big Chicago superstation, and that meant they watched the Chicago Cubs. And the Cubs became a national pastime when the Cubs played in Wrigley Field. Sorry, St. Louis fan supporters. The streets empty. And in fact, when I was down there one day, I read that Queen Elizabeth was coming from England to visit one of her former colonies. But a bigger event was that Gary Matthews, then the Cub star, was coming on a state visit. That, again, was the impact of the television satellite.
Have you been back to Belize since you did that report?
I've been back once, and yes, they now have television, regular television, just as anybody else does.
Are they producing local TV, or is it still American imports?
A lot of American imports. There is some local TV, but it's a poor country. They can't afford to produce the kind of programs they can buy on reruns or get off the satellites. But the point is that it's a global village now, or I shouldn't say it's a global village. It's a lot of villages, and all the villages in the world are now connected globally, and we're all plugged into that same network.
It's the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris talking with Garrick Utley. 3.5 decades of network news coverage with NBC and ABC and now CNN. Let's go back to your early days. One of the first big stories you had to cover was the Vietnam War, where you actually went out in the field and covered the war from the perspective of the soldiers. What did you take with you out into the field? Because, again, we're talking about the early days of network news coverage, field reporters. What could you carry with you? What was your equipment in those days?
Well, it was pretty heavy. This was, of course, television's first war, the Vietnam War. I went out there as a 24-year-old, young, wet-behind-the-ears reporter for NBC News. And I was the first network correspondent actually based in Saigon. And the first thing, before we get to the equipment, was that it was such an unusual situation because we were allowed almost total freedom to roam around the battle zones. Once we got our accreditation with the U.S. military, the South Vietnamese military, there was no censorship there. We were free to go out with the troops, as you say. And boy, did they welcome us. The American GIs, the officers, the enlisted personnel, when they saw us coming down the trail in a potential battle zone, they said, "What the heck are you guys doing here?" And I said, "We're here to tell your story." And we're able to do that. Our problem was that we didn't have these little home video cameras in those days. We had big, bulky, ironclad film cameras, and the poor cameramen, most of them were small, short Vietnamese, really burdened under that. And we couldn't develop any of our film. And, of course, there was no satellite. So we would go out with these bulky cameras, shoot the story as best we could in black and white first, then later in color, living color, as we called it then, and good sound, and shipped it back to the United States. But, Paul, it took 24 to 48 hours before that battle scene was seen back in American living rooms and kitchens. But people didn't mind that. We still were able to convey those first images. That brought the war, the horror of war, the tragedy of war into American homes in the 1960s, and that was a milestone in television news.
So how did the story get back? You're out there, you're in the field with these guys. Yeah. Did you then have to leave the field, get in a Jeep, drive somewhere, drop the film off? What happened?
There were no Jeeps. You got in helicopters. All the transportation was by U.S. military helicopters or South Vietnamese helicopters, and you thumbed a ride. You would be with a military operation. You'd be with these units, and usually there are two of us, a cameraman and myself, and we would find when a helicopter was leaving the battle area, we'd hop on the helicopter, go back to a base, and then have to work our way back through a transport plane to Saigon. We would write the script. We would then put the undeveloped film and the script on a audio tape into a bag. We would take the bag to the airport, put it on a Pan Am 707, which would take its time flying across the Pacific, and 24 to 48 hours later, there it was on television in the United States.
And then you would have to get back on that plane and that helicopter and go back out into the field to work on another story.
And do the same thing. But the drama was there, the tragedy was there in those early days. It was the period of the American escalation, and those who are old enough to remember those days know how that changed American life and our perception of the world. And those of us who are out there actually covering those stories, Paul, we sensed pretty early on that this technology, this thing we had in our hands called a camera and a microphone, and the power those images had back in American homes, that these were having a real impact. And I must say, it was one of my earliest lessons, and I think the other colleagues felt it too. Morley Safer came out about the same time I was there, and we remember we were talking about that one day, that the camera, Paul, the camera became the real reporter in a way we were becoming the caption writers.
And were you reporting stories that the U.S. military was not happy you were reporting?
Sure. They were happy with some of them, not happy with others. The pictures, they were not unhappy with the pictures. The pictures we were showing were the reality. We were there showing the Americans in action, showing the Vietnamese, showing the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong were being captured. That was the reality. The military out there didn't complain all that much. There's a lot of opposition and pressure from the political side back home in the United States, particularly in Washington, from President Johnson's administration, because they didn't like the impact of these pictures. And some people have said that, oh, television lost the Vietnam War. I don't buy that, and a lot of people who have studied, academics and others who have studied it, don't buy it, because the public opinion polls show that support for the war continued pretty much up into about from 64, 65, 66, 67, until it was clear to Americans back home that the war was not winnable. The cost was simply too high. And that's what changed the course of the war as far as the United States is concerned.
It certainly had an impact on the national consciousness, though. I don't think there's been another time in American history where families would sit down to dinner, pull up their black and white TVs, and watch your reports and other reporters reporting from the field of a war. It was so new because it was the first time it had been done that that whole concept of war in the living room had to affect the public consciousness, even if it took several years for it to sink in.
But it wasn't just Vietnam. We have to remember that I joined NBC, as I write in the book, in the summer of 63 as an office assistant to John Chancellor, a great NBC correspondent and anchorman in Brussels. $62.50 a week was my salary.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Hey, big time. Then I went out to Vietnam, and just as the half-hour evening newscast started, was Walter Cronkite on CBS and a guy's named Huntley and Brinkley on NBC. Would you believe it? There were senior executives at the networks who asked whether there would be enough news to fill up half an hour each day. Imagine that. Well, there was, because what happened in the 60s was not just Vietnam, it was the civil rights movement, it was the urban violence we had in too many American cities, it was the counterculture movement by the hippies and others, the free love, the free speech, the beads and all of that. All of these stories were highly visual and highly emotional stories involving Americans one way or the other. That's what galvanized Americans in their homes to sit down in front of their old black and white TV set, and that's what made these half-hour newscasts an institution, which today they really no longer are. But those were the golden days.
When you were out in the field in Vietnam, was your life ever in danger?
Everybody asked that question, and my answer is, you never know whether your life is endangered because you don't know about the bullet that passed you 10 feet away.
True.
Or 1 foot away. Yes, we were in combat a number of times. I was never hit, fortunately. So many of my colleagues were wounded, and some lost their lives out there. I did get a bad case of malaria, but that was the only sort of combat-related injury I had. And you don't get a purple heart for malaria these days.
Were you in Saigon when the American troops were leaving the country?
I was back there twice again in 1968 for the Tet Offensive, and remember how that was the turning point, and then again in 75 for the collapse of South Vietnam. I was not there, Paul, on the actual day they were lifted off the rooftops in those helicopters. Remember that famous picture?
Sure.
I left a couple days before that, but I've been there for 3 weeks for that whole collapse, and I think of all the stories I've covered, that is one of the most memorable, to see those that decade or more of the American engagement out there, the suffering by the Vietnamese, the losses on all the sides, and to finally see it wind down, the whole resistance collapse, and off they went in those helicopters, and that's an event and a story I'll never forget.
What was the mood of the people who were around you at that time, the Americans in particular? Was it a mood of, well, we lost this one, we got to go home and we have to regroup, or something else?
I think it was largely that. We realized that it was lost long before. American troops, remember, had been pulled out of Vietnam and South Vietnam in 1973. We were still supporting the South Vietnamese army, but it was pretty well understood it was lost. What we did not suspect was how quickly the collapse would come. It's very strange. It's something we Americans are not really familiar with. That is, when sort of a structured, organized life suddenly collapses, that is, the government collapses, the police collapse, communication collapse, the airplanes stop flying, and there is absolutely no resistance or no coherence or cohesion left in a society. That's what happened in Saigon in South Vietnam in 1975, and I'd never experienced that kind of a situation before. So it was the rapidity of it. Perhaps we shouldn't be surprised. I mean, look, there's the Mississippi cresting probably on your doorstep right now. You've got all the levees and the sandbags piled up there. You're dry until suddenly it breaches that, and suddenly the waters are flowing in. Well, in a way, not to stretch a metaphor, that's what happened in South Vietnam.
It must have been absolute chaos. Absolute chaos.
It was.
I'm talking with Garrick Utley. The book is You Should Have Been Here Yesterday, A Life in Television News. And after 35 years, he tells some great stories in the book, and I'm having him share some of them with you here today. You also worked behind the Iron Curtain during the Cold War. What was that like, being part of NBC's Moscow Bureau, or going there occasionally to file reports? In the early days, when you first went over there, what was that life like?
When you went to the Soviet Union in the 1970s, the 80s, actually up to the late 80s when Gorbachev came into the Kremlin and eased the restrictions on reporting, it was pretty grim. Journalists who lived in Moscow, who were based there ahead, were very circumscribed in what they could do. They could only talk to a few officials. They didn't live in particularly pleasant quarters. The people wouldn't talk to them on the street. They were very suspicious of the foreigners. It was a police state. And so when we went there, it was fascinating to see this society and how people were trying to live and trying to cope. But we were very limited in our movements. Once Gorbachev came in, of course, once the Soviet Union collapsed, it's a totally different situation today. You can talk to Russians. They're very vocal in their opinions. There's no problem there. But I remember going back one day, talk about television and controlling news, controlling information, what governments try to do. It was one of the big anniversaries, I think the 60th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. And they had organized a big parade, and it finished on Red Square as usual. I think we're familiar with those pictures of the tanks rumbling across in front of the Kremlin and Lenin's tomb there. And in the evening, they had a big fireworks display, and they had in Red Square, and they televised it live. And I was in my hotel room looking out the window over the Kremlin, which was lit up at night, and over this beautiful Red Square with St. Basil's Cathedral with its onion towers and all brilliant colors in the background, and watching the fireworks go up from my window, disappearing, unfortunately, into fog and low-lying clouds. You couldn't see the burst of the fireworks. People were on the ground there were disappointed. I looked at my television set, and Paul, guess what I saw?
What?
I saw brilliant fireworks in the night sky. You know what they were doing? They were televising live the crowd in Red Square and the fireworks going up. The director back in the control room at Moscow Television then cut to a videotape of a film of fireworks against the night sky, shot at some other time, I know not when, know not where, to give the Soviet television viewers all the way to Moscow, to Vladivostok on the Pacific shore, the impression that they were seeing beautiful sky fireworks. The lesson of this, of course, was what you show the people, the Soviet authorities said, is not what's really happening, but what is supposed to happen.
In the glorious empire of the Soviet Union, there is no fog on our fireworks. Everything is always glorious.
Precisely. And that was a lesson about control of the media and the problems you get into when you have that.
Now, you can tell that story now in 2001. Could you have told that story on NBC on that 60th anniversary in 1977 from Moscow, or would they not have permitted it?
They permitted it, yes. We could, for export, for our stories, not being seen in the Soviet Union, of course, but being seen back in the United States, we were allowed to report whatever we wanted. Now, I'll tell you one final footnote to this. A few years ago, I was there when there was one of these coup attempts in Moscow. Remember Boris Yeltsin getting up on the tank? There were a couple of those events in front of the what they call the White House in Moscow. I was in Moscow when one of these happened. This was in 1994, I believe it was. And there was some fighting in the city, and they were shelling one of the government buildings. Moscow television was off the air, except for one local channel. But they had no remote cameras out there to show what was going on, even if they had wanted to be able to do that or had been allowed by the authorities. But they were seeing the event. What were they doing? The shooting was taking place right across the street from the CNN Bureau. The CNN Bureau had a camera on the action, had its own satellite back to Atlanta, Georgia. It went on the CNN satellite, came back into Moscow, into the Soviet Union, or Russia by this time, former Soviet Union. The local Russian station took the CNN image, put it on its local station so people watching television in Moscow on this one channel could see the fighting going on in the center of the city. So there were the Russians watching their own society in a small civil war via an American television station coming out of Atlanta.
Unbelievable.
That's where we are today.
There's the global reach. Now, let's go back to 1989.
Sure.
When you anchored a bulletin that the borders were open in Berlin, and the Berlin Wall was obviously, the crack was more than just apparent, it was widening every day. When you're sitting at NBC News, and I'm guessing you were in New York doing that bulletin, as a reporter, as a person especially who's been covering foreign news for so many years on the international beat, do you get the itch? You're looking at that and you're thinking to yourself, okay, Brokaw's there. I want to be there. I want to be in the midst of this big story right now.
Absolutely, right now. It was a Thursday. I remember it clearly as if it's today. It was a Thursday in November of 1989. Tom Brokaw, we knew something was going to happen dramatically. It was going to happen in Berlin. Brokaw had gone over for his nightly newscast and was broadcasting, preparing to broadcast that night. And I was scheduled to go the next day because I was doing some weekend broadcasts for NBC. But here we were Thursday afternoon, New York time, and we get a call from Tom, who had been at a news conference in East Berlin where the communists had said, in effect, yes, we're going to open up the wall. And there was a lot of confusion. They couldn't believe what they had heard, but they confirmed the story, and we went on the air with a bulletin and announced that to the nation, the first network or news organization to do that in the United States. And then we got Tom on the phone. Now, here's another little aspect or story about technology. Normally, somebody who was in East Berlin, and the Berlin Wall was still up, of course, and there were no direct phone communications from the east to the west, would have had to spend an hour coming back through the customs formalities and report from West Berlin. But Tom had something called a cell phone, one of the first.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't unflip it in those days, one of these bulky, sort of like an old World War II walkie-talkie size. But
With a big box connected to it, right?
Big box connected to it, but yeah. He just powered that up, dialed the number in or punched the numbers in, and we were talking live on television via cell phone as the Berlin Wall was opening up and crumbling.
And you later did get to go and cover that story in person, right?
I went over there because I'd spent time in Berlin as a university student. I had lived there as a correspondent for NBC, and that, again, was one of those momentous events which a foreign correspondent never forgets.
You must have just been walking around saying, you know what, I used to live in this city. This was a day I never thought would come.
It is true. And I'll tell you one of the impressions that struck me. There are so many impressions of the emotion. It's rare that we sense this kind of emotion when literally millions of people were being freed and hundreds of thousands were coming through the wall. Now, here are people who've lived behind the Iron Curtain, behind the Berlin Wall all their lives. They've been locked in, literally. Now, they're aware of what life in the West, the capitalist West, the prosperous West, the free West was about, but they only got it from occasional newspapers that got through, and they could watch West German television, which they could get in East Berlin, if the authorities didn't know they were watching it quietly in their homes at night. So they had a visual image, but what was it like? So they come through the wall on this weekend. And where do they go? Do they go to the museums? Do they go to the parks? No. They all went to the main shopping street.
Ah.
From one side of the main shopping boulevard in West Berlin, from one show window on one side of the shop window on the other side, they were pressing their noses literally against the glass to see for themselves that what they had heard about and thought about was true. It was the prosperity they wanted. That was the great luxury, as well as the personal and political freedom, and I'll never forget that image. That's what people want.
And there is the great success of capitalism in the last century. You know, that's all these people wanted to be a part of, was the free open marketplace, and hey, where can I get blue jeans?
Where can I get blue jeans, and where can I travel? And it's the sense of freedom, because we talk about freedom, and obviously political freedom, the right to vote, is so important. We cherish that in our democracy, and rightly so. But I remember talking to these East Germans, what are the things you really wanted? You know what was number one on the list? It wasn't to vote. The greatest freedom they wanted was to travel and see the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's what people who are locked up really want to do. They wanted to travel and see, and they said, we'll come back. Well, maybe the government leaders, the communists, didn't trust that they would come back. That's what they wanted. They wanted the goodies that the market system, capitalism, was providing in the West. And yes, they wanted the freedom, not just to vote, but the freedom to lead their lives.
And, you know, diplomats are always given, and politicians at the high levels are always given credit for finally getting the Berlin Wall to come down. I always like to give a lot more credit to television, and in particular CNN, because it had been around for, I guess, 6, 7, 8 years by that point. And its global... it's global reach, the fact that somebody could sit in a hotel room in Moscow and watch that, and there could be stolen videotapes or leaked videotapes, if you will, of these international newscasts showing them what the world outside their own borders was like. Don't you think television was a huge influence on the end of the Iron Curtain and the Berlin Wall?
It was a tremendous influence, and not just television. It was all communications technology basically has undermined the control of authority, political authority. authority. Whether you're a Soviet leader, whether you're an East German communist, or even today in China, look at China. Here it is with the market reforms and they're embracing so much capitalism and still trying to control communication. Well, they're not going to be able to do it totally. Television, the internet, fax machines, the message gets through, and you're absolutely right. It was this impact of these images that cannot be stopped because television knows no borders. And again, it's these satellites up there in orbit that they just look down on an Earth. That's all they're seeing down there. They're not seeing any Berlin walls. They're not seeing any borders. They're not seeing any customs agents. It all goes up, and it all comes back down.
I'm Paul Harris here on the Big 550 KTRS, talking with Garrick Utley, who for 35 years plus has been on network television news, 30 of those years with NBC, then a few with ABC, and now with CNN. His book is called You Should Have Been Here Yesterday, A Life in Television News. It is the book of the week this week on my website, harrisonline.com. He has spent many of those years on the road, on planes, in fields, in places around the world that many of us will never go to, and so he was able to bring a lot of that back to us. One continent that it seems to be undercovered in American news is the continent of Africa. And I know you went there and covered the story of Biafra. Do you feel that even here in the year 2001, we're still undercovering Africa?
We're undercovering it in terms of the importance, the size of the continent, and I think the importance of the dramatic importance of so many of the stories there. And I think Africa, as you were mentioning just a moment ago, Paul, is a good example of how television really focuses on conflicts or conflicts we understand. We covered the Biafran War, which was a tragic war in the 60s. We cover for a while when there's a conflict in the Congo. We had this terrible genocide in Rwanda. We'll focus on those stories. We don't, though, focus on Africa day in, day out, even month in or month out. It's been one of those, perhaps of all the continents in the world, South America perhaps runs a close second, that has been largely ignored. We've looked more towards Europe or towards Asia because that's where our big trading partners have been. And that's also where the great international conflicts have been, from Korea and Vietnam wars to the Cold War of the Soviet Union. But I agree with you. In a perfect world, we'd cover a lot more. And at CNN, certainly, on CNN International, there's a lot of coverage to Africa. But you're not going to find very much on network television.
And so you say in the book, the drama of conflict drives international coverage. Is there enough of that conflict now that the Cold War is so far behind us?
This is really what's changed. When that Berlin Wall fell in 89, when the Soviet Union ceased to exist in 1991, we knew instantaneously that the old style of news was gone, because so much of what journalists, not just on television but in print too, had covered from the 1930s to the early 1990s, just think about this for a moment, it was about conflict and drama and threats and potential threats to our existence and lives in the United States. You had the rise of Nazism, you had World War II, you had after World War II, you had the Korean War, you had Cold War, arms races, H-bombs, kids ducking under their desks in schools, you know, during the morning drills, air raid alarms. We had the Cuban Missile Crisis, Vietnam, all the way up for about 50 years. Then it ended. And that, quite frankly, is the challenge facing journalists today. It's a cynical statement that no news is bad news. But you see it at the CNNs and the 24-hour news channels today. You don't have that old conflict to drive the news the way you did. So television news is changing. And what it is becoming, obviously, is covering any kind of a story which has any kind of emotion to it or affects people's lives. Today it's the Mississippi River. Tomorrow it may be something else. These are important stories, but it's not like the Cold War days.
Is it a lot harder for a foreign correspondent to get network television time now than when you were doing it for 30 years for NBC?
At the networks, at the NBC, CBS's, ABC's, definitely the staffs have been cut way back. At CNN, it's not that difficult because we have to remember the CNN we see in the United States is our domestic network or service. We also have CNN International, which is totally separate, which is filled with international reporting. So that's why CNN has more bureaus and correspondents and camera crews than all the other broadcast organizations combined, because it has this international service. And one day when we have those proverbial or promised 200 cable channels in our home, you'll have CNN International along with CNN, the regular CNN, and all the other cable channels there. But there is something important you're getting at here, Paul, and that is that it's not just the number of cable channels. It's this thing called the Internet. You've got a website. We've all got websites or email, or most of us do at least these days. What's happening? What we're seeing at CNN right now, I think, is very significant. We're finding that the news consumers, people who want to know what's going on now, instead of turning to TV or going to CNN.com or other .com sites, because they can get the news, the headlines they want now, they can get the text reports, they can get pictures, they're starting to get video when you want it and how much you want of it. You're in command. They're saying, well, why should I sit and watch a newscast for 30 minutes or 60 minutes on NBC or CNN where the producer or the anchor decides what I'm going to see and in what order? I want to be in control. Therefore, what we're finding, and this is very interesting, I think, and I was quite surprised, some of the lowest-rated programs on the 24-hour news channels, MSNBC, Fox, and CNN, are the newscasts. Because people don't have to tune into the newscast. News is everywhere. You talk about the news. Everybody talks about the news. Therefore, television, whether it's CNN or the networks, is going to become more emotional. It's going to aim at the gut and at the heart rather than at the head, because that's how it's going to compete with the Internet. And we're seeing it happen.
And that's why you see the rise of Dateline NBC and other magazine-type shows on the networks, because they all want to go for the heart and the gut rather than the head, as you say.
And the Bill O'Reillys on Fox and the screaming talking heads at each other and people like that, because even if it's not picture, then you create the emotion and the heat through conflict. You take some issue and you hype it, quite frankly. And that's really a desperate attempt to get people's attention, because the information and the knowledge they can get in their newspapers, their magazines, and now they can get it instantaneously on the Internet.
You know, another reason that I think people are turning away from network television, and this may just be a personal bias of mine. Along with your book, you include this 30-minute CD-ROM, and you kind of anchor a look back at the history of television news. And one of the things that you include in there is almost a full minute of network coverage, I guess it was NBC's coverage that you used, of the funeral of John F. Kennedy after his assassination in 1963. And while I was watching it on my computer from your CD-ROM, I was struck by one thing. Nobody was talking. Now, whenever there's an event, Jennings, Brokaw, Rather, whoever, Judy Woodruff on CNN, whoever it is, they have to fill every second with whatever thought comes into their mind. They have to throw it to this correspondent, throw it to that correspondent. Everybody has to be talking at one time. There's no such thing as let the picture speak for itself anymore.
You're absolutely right, and of course radio is different, because if you don't speak, there's silence. But I think one of the problems in American life today is that we have become afraid of silence.
Yes.
If I speak like this, if you speak, if I stop for 3 seconds like this, you start to get antsy, don't you? Or the viewer may get antsy. What's happened? The radio station's off the air.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes a certain self-awareness. And, of course, anybody in theater who knows drama knows the importance of silence and the pause.
Yep.
And you're absolutely right. Today we feel we have to talk, and silence can be more powerful than an ill-chosen word.
Let's talk, finally, about the day that you say ended 40 years of network news dominance. The day was January 16th, 1991. What happened that day?
That's the day the United States went to war with Iraq. We started bombing Baghdad. I think we all remember that evening and what happened. We were expecting the airstrikes to be launched, and they came on. They began, and we went on the air just before, I believe, during the evening newscast at 6:30 Eastern Time, 5:30 in the Middle West. And Brokaw and the others were doing the show, and we had our correspondents in Baghdad, and I think most of us were watching at that time. And we recall our correspondents reporting with no pictures but via telephone. And then suddenly, after an hour or so, NBC, ABC, and CBS lost the voice communications because the telephone lines went out. CNN, we'll recall, had voice communication because CNN had established an alternate way of getting the voice communication out of the hotel from their correspondents, Peter Arnett and the others. And what happened at NBC that night was dramatic and historic. I was in the newsroom with Brokaw and the others. We were covering the story. And when we lost our reporters a voice, we had no direct information. And suddenly we realized that viewers were turning to CNN because local stations around the country were picking up the CNN feed.
Mm-hmm.
CNN was giving it away. NBC and the others faced a choice. Do we sit here with no reporters, or do we switch and take the CNN reports? And NBC decided to switch, and they took a voice interview from Bernie Shaw, who was there with the CNN team in Baghdad. And Bernie reported to NBC on what was going on. And to my mind, and the minds of those in the room, when we walked out of the studio in the early morning hours, something had shifted away from network news to establishing CNN and the idea of 24-hour news. 7 days a week as the new news network.
You know, I vividly remember watching TV that night as kind of a media freak myself. I, you know, on a night like that when something big is going on, I like to sit in front of the TV and change channels and see who's covering it and how they're covering it. And you're right, CNN was on the air with those hazy green images of the anti-aircraft fire. And I went over to NBC and I saw Brokaw talking and interviewing Bernie Shaw on some live telephone hookup from over there, and he asked Bernie, how are you guys still on the air? And Bernie said, Tom, I can't tell you right now, or he demurred and said, I'll tell you next time we see each other.
Right, he didn't want to give any inside trade secrets. But you know, Paul, I'm going to catch you on one thing there. You just said quite accurately, I remember seeing those hazy nighttime greenish images of the airstrikes.
Yes.
You know what? There were no images that night.
Is that right?
I wrote my book describing it. I wrote the same thing, and somebody pointed it out. That first night, there were no TV images. There was only the voice report. CNN and the others were taping from their hotel rooms those nighttime bombing explosions, and they were able to drive them out. We saw them the next night.
Oh!
But this is how the mind plays tricks on us.
Yes.
Psychologists will tell us. We all imagine that first night watching those explosions against the night sky and listening to Bernie Shaw and the others talking. There were no pictures that night.
And I remember the look on Brokaw's face at the end of that interview with Bernie Shaw, and it was that look that you just described that you must have had on your face, too, which was, uh-oh, we are in trouble here. And now you work with CNN, and there's been some recent uh-oh there. A lot of people have been let go. Have you been okay in all of this?
We've been okay. We had people let off go, about 400 people, which compared to what's happening to a lot of other American corporations these days isn't that much. And it was a painful experience, as it always is. And, of course, we also now are owned by AOL. So here we are. I call this the Ringling Brothers Circus of Media today because it's a seven-ring operation. It's Time Warner. It's CNN. It's Turner Broadcasting. It's AOL as the top owners. It's marrying the Internet with television. It's the tremendous competition you have for the public's attention. It's the facing the pressures of ever more cable channels. And how do you get people to watch what you're doing? And it's doing all of that, and at the same time, trying to maintain a certain standard of journalistic decency and responsibility. And I think we're doing a pretty good job of it, but it's, I'll tell you, Paul, it's not easy because we're having, this is where the rubber hits the pavement. You're having the commercial pressures to make a profit and run a business and the journalistic responsibilities to report the news. And that's a lot.
Sure have come a long way from John Cameron Swayze sitting at a desk and doing live Camel commercials during the Camel News Caravan for 15 minutes every night, haven't we?
We haven't. When I went back into the NBC archives, I got some of those old Camel News Caravans, and if you're really of a certain senior generation, you'll remember that black and white early 1950s, and there was that one scene I have in the CD-ROM here, which I could not believe when I saw it. And the program was 50 minutes long, sponsored by Camel Cigarettes on NBC. And at the end of it was just before Christmas of 1950, I believe, and the anchorman, John Cameron Swayze, he said, that's the news, and say, folks, if you're still looking for a Christmas gift, and he picked up a carton of Camel cigarettes, held it in his hand, and held it up to the camera, and said, pick up a carton of Camels. Nobody could do that today, of course, but who knows what the future will hold.
Garrick, I've had a great time talking with you today and really, really enjoyed the book. And the CD-ROM, you know, talk about the multimedia world that you're in now is a terrific addition to it. Thank you very much for your time today, and good luck with the book as well.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Garrick Utley, the book is called You Should Have Been Here Yesterday, A Life in Television News, and it does include that 30-minute CD-ROM. And, there's a guy whose voice we've known and whose face you've seen on network television for 35 years and who has been there in the heart of both domestic and international news stories throughout that time. What a pleasure to talk to him here on the Big 550 KTRS.